You're listening to the Bon Appetit Foodcast. I'm Adam Rappaport. The holidays are upon us, which means it's time for cocktail parties and dinner parties and all sorts of good entertaining. I sit down with Bon Appetit Associate Editor Emil Stonick and his girlfriend, Chef Lauren Schaefer, who together have this groovy catering company called Mouth to Mouth. They do all sorts of parties. And I talk to them about how to entertain with style and ease. And is that even possible? And then Deputy Editor Andrew Knowlton talks to Brad Thomas Parsons, cookbook author and cocktail nerd extraordinaire, who just came out with Amaro, The Spirited World of Bittersweet Herbal Liqueurs, a book all about that mysterious-seeming drink that's making its way from Italy to the States and deserves your exploration because, like, it's good for you, right? But before we get to all that, do you want to give the gift of Bon Appetit? Because you can give the gift of Bon Appetit. You can get a one-year subscription plus an exclusively designed Headley and Bennett apron. Plus, 10% of each order will go to fund a charity water project helping to bring clean water to developing countries. Normally $85, we are offering 20% off plus free shipping for $68. That's a bargain. So go to bonappetit.com/gift and use the code. Ready? This is the code. F as in Frank, S as in Sam, 20 off, OFF. Once again, FS20OFF. Let's do this thing. Here's Emil and Lauren. Okay, guys, so there is nothing that makes me happier than hosting a dinner party, and yet there is nothing that makes me more stressed than hosting a dinner party.
We're stressed, really? You keep it together pretty well.
If things go off well, but there's so many moving parts to a dinner party beyond just what you're cooking, correct?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I mean, I feel like that to speak to that stress, it's like the dinner party only goes as well. Like, you were only as relaxed as you are when the first guest walks in, you know?
No. Like, wait, meaning what?
Meaning, like, if you are, like, scrambling last minute to, like, you know, prep ingredients for later, or you're putting beverages on ice or whatever, like, or tidying up, like, while people are walking through the door, you're already, like, behind. Mm-hmm. And that, I feel like, sets you back because you're trying to be, you know, a gracious host, and you got to make sure people get drinks and, you know, they're there to see you. So to me, the most important thing is just budgeting yourself way too much time.
Mm-hmm. And so you should budget too much time.
You should budget too much time so that when people show up, you're like,
you're chill.
You're chill.
You're showered. You're looking good.
You have your party outfit on.
Ooh.
You have your glasses all lined up, ready to pop that first bottle.
Okay. I like that. All right. So I'm in the mood now. Okay. All right, so hosting a dinner party, there's a lot of logistics, but can we agree that it starts with the food? You still got to decide, like, what are we cooking, right, Lauren?
I definitely think it starts with the food. I think it's about getting excited about something you want to eat and something that you want to share with your friends or your dinner guests.
Does it need to be fancy?
It needs to appear fancy,
ooh.
I think.
Which means what?
I think for me it means something that maybe people don't cook for themselves or think of as fancy, but when presented on a beautiful table, it's everyone wants to dig in.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. So let's talk about it. All right. So Emil, let's talk about, like, it's the holiday season now. Take me through what might be a good dinner party menu and how and why do you pull it off?
Well, so to me, I mean, I think one of the really special things about cooking at home is you either need to have time or money, but you don't need to have both necessarily. I mean, you do need some money, but if you have a lot of time, you can, you know, put something together that is really fancy feeling and there's a lot of, like, time and effort put into it, but you don't have to necessarily break the bank. So, like, for example, a chunk of pork shoulder, which, you know, you can get a good sized piece of pork shoulder or like a chuck roast if you're going beef, and normally start with a braise. You know, I feel like that's kind of like the jumping off point, because you've got a big piece of meat. It's going to be, like, fall apart, tender and delicious after you've cooked it for many, many hours. And it's going to be just as impressive as that, like, $60 ribeye, but you maybe spent $12 on it.
Also, what I love about braising, whether you're braising a pork shoulder or short ribs, the house smells amazing. When guests walk in, you're like, oh my God, it smells so good. And then also, I think what's cool to your point, I think when you make something that's not fancy, guests, they relax. They're less intimidated. When you start to put something homey down. But to your point, Lauren, like, if you're going to put
braised pork shoulder. You want to present it in a way that feels festive and not just like your mom's making, you know, pork, you know, making a pot roast on a Tuesday night.
It's the time to break out the garnishes. I also feel like braising meat really speaks to like luxury because it's not every night that we get to go home and braise something. It has to, like
Getting
Emil
back
said,
to, you need time.
You need time.
And you don't have that during the week.
We need time or money, right? If we're focusing on that, it's like time is the most beautiful thing that you can offer your guests, right? And money really can't compare. It doesn't matter if you bought lobster. The fact that you spent a lot of time and then you're presenting it in a beautiful way.
All right, let's talk about that. You guys have mentioned about sort of accoutrements and stuff and the notion of a one-pot meal. So let's talk specific. Give me some examples of what a great dinner party can entail, a menu.
I mean, to me, like one real, I feel like go-to for us is, you know, something like stewy, braisy, ragu-y, like, you know, pork shoulder and tomato sauce, something like that. And then you have like a big pot of polenta. And, you know, that also helps to kind of, you have something like saucy and intensely seasoned, like a, you know, a pork ragu. Ladling that over some soft, you know, cheesy polenta is just like, nobody hates that, you know? And then all you need after that is like a nice crunchy salad, maybe some frisée or some, you know.
Bitter greens.
Bitter greens, yep. Some escarole would be delicious with like an anchovy, garlicky dressing. And that's like, you know, you kind of have, I know Adam's like looking at me when I say anchovy, garlicky dressing.
It's okay,
like,
I can roll with it.
Yeah. But, you know, it's like there, like right there, you have like a super simple, like not too crazy menu that, you know, once that's all on the table, everybody's like, wow, this feels like I'm at a restaurant. This feels really exciting. And, you know, maybe you like make a little green sauce, just like puree some parsley and basil with some oil and put a little salt in that. And all of a sudden you've got like a condiment and, you know, it's like people love sauce.
And you can also, I mean, a couple of things. You can make that sauce a day ahead.
Totally.
And we can talk about this, about getting started earlier than you think. Get some things out of the way. Also, what I love about doing braises, whether, like I said, whether it's pork shoulder or, you know, ossobuco, whatever, it can sit. You're not doing it a la minute, as the French would say. You're not making something right there in a hot pan to plate and serve your guests like you're fancy at a restaurant. It's in the back of the stove. It's just hanging out, waiting for you to serve it.
Totally. And the thing that's great about a lot of braises like that is that you can just do it the day before.
Where I always get stuck, and what you guys are really good at with your catering company. Call it a catering company? What do we call it?
We call it mouth to mouth.
Mouth to mouth.
That's what we've decided upon.
Meal party service. I don't know what
you want
to call it.
We feel like that's all inclusive.
Yeah. You guys do like cocktail hors d'oeuvre hour really well, and I never know what to serve because I'm always thinking about the braise and like the pureed potatoes or the polenta and making the salsa verde. And then I'm like, oh yeah, I need to serve something when guests walk in the door, and I start to panic and freak out.
Yeah.
And talk about some of your techniques. Like what works well at that sort of cocktail hour?
I think one thing that works really well, which I've only recently discovered, is putting a delicious snack at the bar where people are serving themselves to get drinks when they walk in. Even if you're helping the first few guests pour champagne, before you know it, everyone, I think, is into making themselves a drink and bonding over that. I love putting snacks at that area.
Okay, like snacks meaning what?
I think
Give me some details.
I think a snack can be as simple as olives with a dish for pits or toothpicks.
Okay.
I also think like marinated feta is lovely and something that people can easily pop in their mouths and it's identifiable and they don't need an explanation.
And marinated feta being feta with olive oil and herbs and stuff?
Olive oil, herbs. I think something obviously so they can just pop it in their mouth and get rid of that. They're walking around with just their drink from that point on, but they're already eating. They're already feeling like it's a party and when it's right by the drink, while they're waiting for their friend to pour themselves something, they can put something in their mouth.
All right, so you get your little bar snacks, but then you also do really well what my wife likes to refer to as hipster crudité. Talk to me about that, Emil, and that includes beautiful-looking vegetables with a cool dip. Talk to me about both.
Well, you know, I mean, I think to me the best, you know, this is – there's a little bit of controversy here within Lauren and my relationship. She's over crudité.
What?
Let the record stand.
Do not tell my wife that. She's going to be just crushed.
Hey, you know, the customer's always right.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, to me, I don't want people to fill up, you know, but I still want them to
have. Exactly. I'm always worried that they're going to be so filled up, then they're not going to want to eat the polenta and the pork.
Right. Which, you know, at the end of the day, never has anybody sat down at the table and been like, oh, but
no,
I just...
No, they have. They fill up on bread. Don't fill up on the bread. That's well, like, I literally have like a library stamp that says that. Because people make that mistake. They go to like Peter Luger's and they fill up on the onion rolls. I'm like, dude, what are you doing? You're about to just spend $90 on steak and you're eating 28 cents onion rolls with
too
much butter.
The onion rolls are good there, though.
I know, but you have like half of one.
But yeah, I mean, so to your point, I think that, you know, you want food that is... feels substantial, but is also light and fresh. And
okay, so talk to Art. So crudité, right, get to
right,
the point,
right,
yes.
Calm down. So, you know, it's like no matter what time of year it is, you can go to the farmer's market, you can get some, you know, vegetables that first and foremost look beautiful.
Yes.
You know, so you've got your, you know, beautiful cauliflower, maybe some like Romanesco, the beautiful green. It kind of looks like a cross between cauliflower and
it's like if Godzilla ate broccoli. It's got little like sort of cool like horns, green horns.
Totally.
Out of it. Yeah.
Radishes are always great.
All different shapes and colors.
You know, you just want, especially during the winter time, you want to take some of those root vegetables and just shave them really thin. And then have, you know, so I like to really like to do a, like a ranchy sort of homemade yogurt, buttermilk, mayo sauce with lots of herbs and garlic.
You also, I like what you do sometimes. You also, you're a proponent of, in terms of filling up a little bit, sort of a poaching or just boiling whatever, little baby potatoes and then chilling those and putting those out also.
Oh my God. Yeah. Cold boiled fingerling potatoes. As long as you season that cooking water really well, so they're like nice and seasoned. It's, I mean, I'm not going to say it's better than a French fry,
but dipped
in ranch. Yeah. It's really good.
All right. So a homemade ranch, you're doing yogurt.
So basically kind of equal parts yogurt or sour cream, depending on like what the crowd's like. And mayonnaise, and then you want to thin that with buttermilk. And so once it gets to kind of like a dressing-like consistency, then you just microplane a couple of cloves of garlic in, season it with plenty of salt, and then whatever herbs you have lying around, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I love doing a combination of like kind of herbs that people won't pick out necessarily. So it's like, you know, you could do dill and cilantro and basil and parsley, and people are just like, oh, it just tastes
clean. Anytime I notice when you guys do a gig, you show up with like Ziploc bags full of fresh cleaned herbs, and whether you're mixing them in a dressing or then putting them on top of a braised meat to awaken that, or just like,
well, it really gives you flexibility.
Yeah.
When you have those herbs all picked ahead of time, it really gives you the flexibility to then kind of make that last minute decision and decide where it really belongs, I feel like I treat the vegetable like, where does it want to go? Mm-hmm. Who wants to eat it? And then getting that food to the person.
But herbs are so interesting. I think what's great about fresh herbs is that they sort of, it's like an alarm goes off and they wake up a dish. Like,
yes,
you might have prepared that dish a day ahead, like we talked about. You throw some fresh herbs on there and all of a sudden it's like, ooh, I'm awake.
And it's beautiful,
you
right?
Do, yeah. You, speaking of beautiful, you also do a dip, this crazy, what is that beet dip you do? Like a beet tahini or something? It's like this bright fuchsia color.
Yeah.
It's insane.
Basically anything that you puree a beet into is going to be beautiful, whether it's yogurt. I feel like beet hummus is really popular right now.
And so you,
beet with tahini.
You roast the beet and what do you do with the beet?
Really, you can do whatever you want. If you want that beet to be a little bit sweeter, roasting it and then peeling off that skin.
Mm-hmm.
I love to steam roast.
Okay, but you still have to cook the beet. You can't just puree a raw beet, right?
You know, you could grade the beet, and if you throw that in a high-powered blender, and that's it.
And if you have like that as one dip and Emile's homemade ranch dressing as another and some beautiful vegetables, I mean, that's kind of good. Like, get back with the crudité. Come on, Lauren.
I I'm just interested in exploring new ways of serving crudité. I think that's really my thing. Lately, I've been into really saving all, especially if you're making the effort to go to the farmer's market and buying those extra special, beautiful vegetables that you can't even really find at your local supermarket. I think saving all, they're always like, do you want the tops or not? Save the tops. Those are the most beautiful thing to put your crudité on top of.
Ooh, yeah, you're really good at presentation. Like I said, you eat with your eyes first. And we're not talking about just going to get those little carrot nubs and celery sticks.
No.
Buy some interesting vegetables. Make a cool homemade dip. I did cook dinner recently. A friend was coming over. It wasn't really a dinner party. But I made spaghetti and meatballs and made good meatballs, recipe from the meatball shop here in New York. We put ricotta in the meat mixture, made a good basic tomato sauce, tossed them in there, and bought out this big platter of the pasta with the meatballs and sauce together. Mm. And we made homemade garlic bread, which is not that hard to do. You cut some bread in half and you put some shaved garlic and herbs and butter on there, and you wrap it up in tin foil, put it in the oven. And it was just so good. And a nice bright green salad. And like, if you serve that for 6-8 people, no one will complain.
No.
Everyone will go home happy. This notion that people think, I think the biggest mistake, if I may, that home hosts make is that they think they need to cook restaurant type food.
Oh, yeah.
And it just, they have to plate it and make it look fancy. Like, people don't come to your house for fancy food. People come to your house for home cooked food and to hang out with you.
Yeah. To enjoy your company, hopefully, right?
Yeah.
Well, you know, in the words of Julia Kramer, my colleague Julia Kramer's husband, Zach Kaplan, Julia, they're getting a free meal. Like, it's kind of like, you can't stress out too much.
So let's go through it. So we have some beautiful crudité, a couple of dips. We've got a couple of bar snacks, whether it's feta or maybe some Marcana almonds or olives on the bar. You have a couple of bottles of Prosecco or champagne. People are pouring themselves a drink. They're happy. But rewind to get to that point, Lauren, if I may, and I don't want to throw a meal under the bus here. Being neat and tidy, maybe not a meal's strong suit. But when you cook, it's like there's no one even there. Like, you never see a spot of anything. Can you talk about cleaning as you cook so that when the first guest does come over, it doesn't look like a tornado just hit the kitchen?
Sauvage.
I really do feel like it comes with practice. But I also think that if you make an effort to clean as you cook, everything will make so much more sense.
Like, talk about it. What does that mean, clean as you cook? Like, what do you specifically do?
Basically, anytime I open or empty any jar or any container, I immediately try to get it out of my vision, whether that means putting it in the recycling or throwing that in the dishwasher. But keeping that space clean will just save you so much stress, even if that stress is all in your mind.
Yeah, your workspace. I've seen your workspace, and it looks like you work at the Apple store. It's just like clean and white, and there's like two things. And
I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm so flattered.
And I'm like,
right,
how did you just make all this food? But yeah, and it's just like, it's wiping it down, it's putting stuff in recycling, it's throwing the carrot ends in the disposal or whatever.
Or deciding you want to save
or
them.
Or use those carrot ends.
Yeah.
And also, when you have too many things going on in front of you, and there's just too many things hanging out, you forget to put an ingredient in because it's behind that container and you're like, oh my God, I forgot to put the pepper in or whatever. But one thing I find, there are so many other things that go into a dinner party that have nothing to do with the food. And especially if you're having a dinner party with 10 or 12 people, I mean, it's kind of like throwing a pop-up restaurant in your house. Like, oh, do you have votive candles? What about flowers? Did you go to the store to buy ice? Like, do you even have enough knives and forks or plates to serve that many people? What about chairs? So like, there's a lot of questions you need to ask yourself before you even begin cooking.
Definitely. I think there's definitely a checklist that you kind of need to go down in your mind, and that it's all going to make it so much easier. One thing that I really like to do is kind of counting those plates out and just setting them aside ahead, and even thinking about dessert.
Yeah.
So counting out those dessert spoons or dessert forks, glassware ahead of time, and having that in a nice, easily
accessible area.
Yeah.
Are you serving the dessert on a dessert plate or in a bowl or in a little glass or whatever? Like, well, yeah, you got to
having those spoons sitting out.
Are you a fan of the to-do list? Where you literally take a piece of paper and write stuff out.
I am not a fan of the to-do list. When
you know
it
who
comes...
is? This guy right here.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's nice because when you write it and you tape it, that was one of those things where you ask someone a question because basically you just want to give them the answer.
Yeah.
But like, literally, I will write it and like tape it to the wall. Emil, do you do that? I know Christine Mulkey.
I do that.
Does it a lot.
I really like doing colleague. That. I really like, you know, if we're doing like a catering gig, we'll make like 3 or 4 of those lists, you know, just like Friday night, you know, it's like the events on Sunday, like Friday night, here's what we're prepping. Here are all the dishes and all the things that we can do. The next day, you like still have a few things circled. You make a new list with like all the new things. And that way, I mean, I think that helps to keep things for me really organized and to feel like accomplished.
Yes,
you know?
Well, there's nothing better than taking that Sharpie and crossing something off. You're like, ooh.
But I do think it's really important, and something that I'm only now just learning to do, is it's not enough to make your prep list like just by individual dishes. You need a separate column that's just like all of the non-food things. So yeah, that is like counting out your plates. That is like seeing if you have enough dessert plates, or maybe you're like, you know what, I'm gonna make a dessert that's gonna go in a bowl because I don't have enough dessert plates.
It's like you're in high school and you're making your outline with 1 and 1A and 1B and everything.
Yeah, totally.
All that sort of stuff. Let's talk dessert, because that is the sort of the analog to my hors d'oeuvre anxiety. Then I'm like, oh shoot, I gotta think of dessert also. And am I baking that ahead of time, or like, you know, talk to me about some dessert strategy. I was at a party recently, you guys, and you did the cool little like chocolate puddings in glass. What was that exactly?
the easiest chocolate cake that just puffs up and everyone's like, wow, it's a souffle, but it really is just chocolate, some whiskey, coffee, sugar, eggs.
You made the batter ahead of time, or what did you do?
You can make the batter ahead of time, whisk it all together. You can store it for probably up to a week in the refrigerator.
Wow, okay.
I would say.
And then after dinner, you put the oven on, and what'd you do?
After dinner, you can leave that oven on if you already had it. If you already had it going for your braise or whatever was in your oven. Pour that batter into cups. Stick the whole tray of whatever that may be. And I think everyone...
So put all the cups on like a sheet tray.
Put all the cups on a sheet tray. It could also be coffee mugs. Mm-hmm. I feel like everyone has coffee mugs. Put that in the oven. It comes out hot. Serve it with cream. Fragrant. Very important. Mm. Smells like chocolate in your whole home.
Yeah. Well, and everyone, a hot dessert people go bonkers for.
Yeah,
it feels super fancy. And I think part of the thing also that's so nice about that is like once, you know, like people have eaten, you know, there's kind of the whole scene at the table. Everyone's like a little drunk, you know, they're just kind of talking and people aren't thinking about what you're doing. So then you get to kind of sneak in the kitchen. Yeah. Also kind of take a moment to like, take a breath.
High five each other.
And then everything's just, you know, the batter is made, goes in, you know. And then when you bring that to the table, people freak out.
That's a neat thing to do. You do the work ahead of time and then just let the oven finish it off.
Mm-hmm. Well, and something that, Lauren, you do a lot that I really like is, you know, you'll have the kind of dessert that is ready to be made and will come out hot. Then you also will put some fruit, whether it's fresh or dried or like a few nuts or something on the table.
Some sort of seasonal fruit, some Concord grapes.
Very Chapinese.
Or the little... tangerine. What are the little guys called that at Christmas
Clementines?
Time? Clementines. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Everyone loves a Clementine.
So
easy to peel.
Easiest thing to eat. No fragrant. Sticky fingers.
Exactly. Yeah. So yeah, Clementines, little chocolate pudding souffles thing. That's perfect. Before we go, guys, any parting words, any advice for throwing a stress-free and successful dinner party?
Don't run out of wine.
Yes. Because you know what? It's not going to go bad. If you don't open it, you can drink it tomorrow.
Yeah,
don't
celebrate your accomplishments.
Don't run out of paper towels.
Yes, a lot of paper towels. All right, guys, thank you so much. Lauren and Emil.
Thank you.
Thanks, Adam.
All right, that was Emil and Lauren. And now here is Deputy Editor Andrew Knowlton with cocktail authority and author Brad Thomas Parsons.
Brad Thomas Parsons, welcome to the BA Foodcast.
Great to be here. Good to see you, Andrew.
You're this interesting cat because you have a day job. What's your day job?
I do. My day job, I'm the executive director of culinary marketing at a publisher called Houghton Mifflin Harcourt here in New York. So I work with a lot of authors like Dory Greenspan and Jacques Pepin and Mike Solomonoff and big brands like Betty Crocker and Weight Watchers and... But I'm published by a different publisher, Ten Speed Press.
Well, you're keeping your day job.
Yes.
But your other job is much more cool. You, I think kind of like me, started as a barfly almost, right? You started as a barfly going, and then you got into cocktails hardcore. And then 4 years ago, or not even that long, five years ago, you came out with a seminal book that is... Every bar I go to, not only in New York, not only in the United States, but around the world, it's like required reading for bartenders, and it's called Bitters.
Yes. Yeah. So I've been really fortunate that book has really become a well-stamped passport of a book where at least once a week I get a text from someone or a photo. They're in Tokyo or Helsinki, and there it is behind the bar. And that means so much to me because I never would want to write a disposable book where you just read it and throw it away. And that people turn to it on a regular basis and mark it up and post filled with post-it notes really means so much. And I've gotten a couple pictures from Amaro so far. Amaro definitely made it to Italy. And I just got a picture from Cartagena, like a popular bar in Cartagena, and Kuala Lumpur.
So, to say that, your new book, which just came out in October?
October 11th, yeah.
Is Amaro. So you like the kind of obscure, single topic, nerdy kind of bar books. But there's obviously an audience, and we can talk a little bit about this cocktail revolution, which is, I think, giving you your audience in a lot of ways. So my first question in terms of Amaro is, what the hell is Amaro? Because even somebody like myself who's been in it, I'm confused about when is a vermouth and Amaro... does Amaro have to be drunk after? So what mm-hmm. is your, I'm a dumb guy, what's Amaro?
Well, that was the biggest, the basic, Amaro means bitter in Italian. That's the easiest thing to say. But it also represents this class of after dinner digestifs that are primarily Italian in origin that are bittersweet and herbal.
Okay.
So those are some key factors in it. So that's why things like chartreuse technically mm-hmm. isn't an Amaro. It's an herbal liqueur. Mm-hmm. Vermouths typically are wine-based versus spirit-based, although there are many wine-based Amaro. and also wormwood is a defining bittering agent in vermouth, and there's regulations about how much is in it to be called a vermouth. The wild thing about Amaro and the frustrating and also exhilarating thing is this lack of definition, classification. So you think of like whiskey or mezcal, tequila, beer, wine, all these sort of rules mm-hmm. where this is a porter, this is an IPA. Amaro, every bottle you're dealing with, for the most part, proprietary recipes have been passed down for generations. Secret production.
Centuries. The case of Italy, centuries,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I mean, so most of the people I spoke with were fourth, fifth, sixth generation, but the commercial Amaro date back to like 1815 and much earlier kind of homegrown versions. So for the sake of, but then you think of like one of our favorites, Underberg from Germany, that's an herbal digestif that's bitter. Jägermeister, sort of a spicy schnapps, but falls in that category. So Germany has a tradition.
So is Jägermeister an Amaro?
I call it an Amaro. They technically, it
so
is.
So in college, I was drinking Amaro.
Yeah, that was the,
nice.
We all were drinking Amaro and probably didn't realize it. Because I always think like, oh, Fernet Branco was my first Amaro. But I'm like, no, it was, you
it was
know,
Jägerbombs.
It was Jägerbombs at SUNY Oswego. I think it is, again, it's very, it's a loosely defined category. So I, for the sake of the book and this project, I wrestled with it a lot, but I opened this kind of big umbrella where if it's intentionally bitter, sweet, and herbal mm-hmm. and intended as a digestif, it was fair game.
It's Amaro.
Yeah.
Okay.
But going back to Italy now, so Italy, as you know, very regionally driven and protective of things like their cheese and their prosciutto,
yes.
Their the DOC. So many Italians I interviewed for the book were like, it must be made in Italy to be called Amaro. And they were adamant about that. But then you look, there's Amaro now made in Charleston, in Brooklyn, Mexico, Trinidad. So the genie's out of the bottle on that front. But the other big thing that they really were adamant about was Amaro is more than the drink. It's the act of when you drink it at the end of a meal. It's a digestif. But if we'll get into it talking about why it's blown up in the last few years is American bartenders sort of taking these dusty bottles and putting them into cocktails as a key ingredient in cocktails. So
let's, like 30 years ago when maybe there was a few, like you said, dusty bottles at some old Italian American restaurant.
Yeah.
Was that
6 years ago?
6 years ago. Was that simply Italian-American people bringing them over and having them after dinner?
I think that's the case. Because if you think about it, a digestif really could be a glass of whiskey.
Right.
It could be Sambuca, Limoncello, Grappa. But I think seeing, the Italian-American tradition of people, you know, opening a restaurant. But a lot of times, going out to eat in high school, well, college more, you go to an Italian restaurant, it was always like Sambuca came out or something.
Right.
So I saw those bottles there and you see them. And in Italy, that was definitely the case. Like every cafe we went to, they'd put a bottle on the table at the end with your espresso.
And that's when I've seen it is well-dressed men, usually men, having an espresso and then having some sort of dark kind of brownish liquid that they
exactly.
were. I remember going to Florence in college and seeing this and then having some of it. And being like, oh, hell no, I can't.
Yeah.
I couldn't handle it. I discovered Campari because that was like a lighter bitter and you mixed it with a little soda water.
Mm-hmm.
Campari, which has gone, you know, famously through the Negroni, that is not an Amaro.
That was another like 3 months of struggling because I knew I couldn't have a book called Amaro without having the Negroni in there and Campari because it's
a bitter.
It's bitter.
Yeah.
you know, that kind of tricky taxonomy of the subject where, so Amaro means bitter, but Italians call Campari a bitter, but in English, B-I-T-T-E-R.
Right, it says it on the...
Yeah, it says, yeah. It's like, and so it's bitter Campari.
Right.
So I struggle that a lot. So the reality is I call it an aperitivo bitter. So it's a light, and some of the key factors are typically not drunk on its own, like you said, soda's right. added. More likely to have it at the beginning of a meal is an aperitivo to spark your appetite rather than settle your appetite.
Right.
Usually lower proof in alcohol, lower ABV, more citrus forward, that red color. And then, but the reality is a lot of those bittering agents to define what makes an Amaro, gentian, cinchona, things like that. Same things are in there. It's right. just they're tweaked. And so it's like one of the Amaro producers I talked to from Washington, D.C., who's a third generation Italian from the Amalfi Coast, in his romantic way, he always says, let the color of the spirit guide when you drink it. So red is at sunset, you know, the brown or darker ones if you're after. After
interesting. Dinner. So let's switch gears a little bit. I just want to briefly hear what you think happened in American like drinking habits that opened the door for basically the bitter cocktail era that we're in. Mm-hmm. Meaning it used to be traditionally a sweet thing. People wanted sweet cocktails. Yeah. And then there was this revolt led by people we know, and then we got in line with them. And it's switched, it seems, for the time being, to bitter cocktails. You know, I used to mm-hmm. ask when I would go to a bar, I would ask for a dry cocktail or something yep. that wasn't sweet. And now I hear people going to a bar saying, I want something bitter.
Brown bitter and
brown
stirred.
Bitter. So yes, what the hell happened? Like what, and opened the door for somebody like yourself mm-hmm. to write an Amaro book. And then, you know, you've got three bottles in front of you, one from New York, and I've never seen these. Like, so what happened?
You know, Americans tend, a bitter is a flavor we hadn't really adopted right. for years.
It was too European for
yeah,
us.
Right? Yeah. So you think of like, I think of like the Italian children eating anisette candy and
licorice.
You know, licorice. And for us, you know, obviously the bitterness in food has been more accepted, like kale and coffee culture.
Right. So good chocolate.
Chocolate. Yeah. So, but I really think the Negroni was a cornerstone in of a cocktail to turn people to it. So my personal narrative with it, I thinking back, you know, like Fernet Branca was really my first kind of, this was like when I was living in Seattle and that's when I was having the bartender's handshake where you get a shot of it when you walk in or when you leave for the night. So that was sort of my first experience.
What is Fernet Branca for people who don't know?
Oh, so that's another whole while. Some people, Fernet is a subcategory of Amaro. Typically, there's about a half dozen common ingredients like saffron and aloferox and rhubarb root. And it's this bracingly bitter, very medicinal, kind of tastes like toothpaste and a candy cane.
And it became the thing on the West Coast as like a bartender shift drink,
yes.
right?
So going back to the Italian-American immigrants in San Francisco, brought it with them, carried the shop at their shops and stores and restaurants, and it became like the bartender's handshake. It was a way to welcome someone to the bar, say goodbye to a shift drink, to test their mettle because it was bitter, it was strong, it was black, it was weird. You know, the other issue too was there weren't a lot of Italian Amaros available in the States. Even now, like I've been out on this book tour and going to like Memphis or Chicago or Nashville, different cities, some of them don't have Averna and Varnelli and some of the ones that we can take for granted we can get here in New York.
And that's
or some
just
other
distribution
city.
Is just different.
It's state-by-state distribution. Yeah. But more and more, since I even written the book, there's been like 6 to 8 new bottles that have come to the States. And I always say, like, it starts with the bartenders. Like, the bartenders embrace the new, the unusual, the weird. And bitter is something that can really get behind because it's aggressive, mm-hmm. Cleanses the palate at the end of a shift, like you said. And it becomes their kind of secret code. And then the people like us, barflies and cocktail geeks who hang out at the bar, they get past the shot.
Right.
They get into it. Where can I buy this? I want to learn more.
Right.
But it really is the bartenders have been our ambassadors to it. And the Negroni was a huge part because it's a drink that's bitter when you taste it. And you're like, oh, I don't like this. Or, wow, I really like this. Or I'll learn to like it. And from there, you have that template where you can do Negroni variations. So the equal parts cocktail.
That's why I think it got big was it's just
so easy to make.
A third of Campari. a third of
sweet vermouth and gin. So
I can remember that. You can even remember when I've had a few.
I tell a story in the book where I was at this bar called Barnacle in Seattle, and it's this aperitivo bar, and totally geeked out, wall full of Amaro, vermouth. Geeking out with the bartender, trying this, trying that. I've never heard of this. What's this? What's that? Then a couple came in next to me, and they weren't as happy, and they ordered, like, give me a gin and tonic. So I was kind of like, oh, man, you got all these bottles here. You ordered, but to each their own. Of course, it was made with, like, local Seattle gin, beautiful bottle of tonic. Treat them like a great guest. And then the guy just looked at, he was getting frustrated about the wait, but also he's like, he goes, I don't know what the blank any of these bottles are. Right. And so when I wrote I had just started writing the book. And so that guy's voice is always in my head when I talk about it. Cause like you and I and many others in your bartending friends can geek out on it and try weird stuff. And there's people who've never had like Chinar, Campari, Averna. Right. And so a big part of this category and this book is demystification. We're like, what is it? Don't be afraid. Here's ways to try it.
Right.
Because he's got these beautiful labels, but they have funny names.
Yeah, they're hard to even for me to decipher. So the holidays are right around the corner. Mm-hmm. So if somebody is listening to this podcast, which they are.
Hopefully.
and they want to get into Amaro or they want to buy a gift, what's the one kind of gateway Amaro that most people around the U.S. can get that you would recommend?
That's a great question. I mean, not talking about Campari, tin Campari off the table. Yeah. I like to say Averna.
Averna. So that's
A-V-E-R-N-A.
Okay.
That was my first gateway Amaro I call these like Goldilocks Amaros too, where they're not too bitter, not too sweet. They're just right. And that's why bottles like Averna and Lucano and Maletti are very popular in cocktails because they play well
with others,
especially brown spirits. And it's got this cola kind of taste. It's a lightly herbal, a little nuttiness. And you can use that. I love that on its own. Just that's a whole other category of like service of Amaro.
So if somebody is trying it for the first time or they're breaking out at the holiday table,
I say put a bottle down with glasses, just neat. So like
and room temperature.
Room temperature, yeah. If we went to 10 different restaurants in the city today and ordered an Averna, we would get it 10 different ways at the end of the meal.
Right.
It might come in a tulip stemmed glass. It might come in a rocks glass.
Right.
It might come in a wine glass, a shot glass, a bistro style glass. It might be chilled. It might not be chilled. So, and that happens in Italy too. So like even the Amaro Lucano is another Southern Italian Amaro. And the brothers I interviewed and their father, the brothers drink it one way, the father drinks it one way, and their grandfather drinks a different way. So if the producers can't agree, like what's accurate, like who am I to say? So, for a meal at home, I would just put the bottle out with some glasses, make it casual. It can be a bridge to dessert before dessert, or it can be served with dessert and a coffee or espresso.
So I was at a place in Boston, an Italian place, and they had a little menu where they were shaking the Amaro with ice.
Oh, really?
And then I think putting a little soda water on top. And it was like cold and refreshing, and it wasn't... Sometimes Amaros can be a little syrupy to me, like a viscous, a viscous.
But to that note too, with Averna, another, you think of the like taking it beyond the digestif, just put some tonic in it with a citrus too. That was one of my summer drinks this year too. And then you can also put that into a cocktail like the Black Manhattan, which is like a Manhattan variation where you use Amaro instead of vermouth, and it's delicious.
So Amaro, your new book, there's loads of recipes. What's the one cocktail that you think people should be discovering making from the book?
Oh, it's a good question. It's interesting to see like what organically comes out from it. And I have found, like I just mentioned, the Black Manhattan is one that it's a really easy one to make. It came from Bourbon and Branch in San Francisco, and it's Averna, bourbon, bitters, and it's just sort of like you're swapping in the Amaro instead of the vermouth. Really easy to make, and it's approachable. It doesn't look scary. One of my personal ones in the book, so about 10% of the recipes are mine and the other are from bartenders, but there's a drink. So in my first book, Bitters, there was a drink called the Autumn Sweater that was sort of the breakout drink. And in this one, there's a drink called the Smith Streeter, which is named after a mutual friend of ours, Chris DeCrosta. And it's kind of tall, cool, bitter, refreshing. It's rye, Amaro Lucano cold brew coffee, orange bitters, and tonic. So it was kind of my taste, my
it's
twist.
It's a dangerous cocktail, I have to say, because you got caffeine and booze
exactly.
in the same
so
thing.
I saw Chris as like tall, bitter, cool kind of guy. And so that's been what picked up a bunch by people talking about the book. They've signaled that one out as I think the mix of coffee and Amaro and booze is a fun combo. But there's and it's interesting too, because I've seen a lot of Instagrammers are making cocktails from the book and shooting them mm-hmm. and saying, I didn't have a Lucano, but I tried it with a Verna and it worked. But next time I'll do this. And so it's interesting to see what people have available and what people are drawn to. But I have seen a lot of Black Manhattans, and the Smith Streeter has been a darling from
the
book.
So for the holidays, go pick up Amaro by Brad Thomas Parsons, BTP, as he's known in New York City. But before you go, we have our lightning round questions
to do.
So I have to have an answer. Don't think too hard about it.
Okay.
This one might be hard. This is like choosing between children here. Amaro or bitters?
Book or drink?
I don't know.
Amaro.
Rocks or neat?
All rocks.
Bourbon or rye?
Bourbon.
The Vegas Strip or Bourbon Street in New Orleans?
I got to go Bourbon Street.
Yeah, I think you're correct. Manhattan or martini?
Probably Manhattan.
Cocktail the movie or The Thin Man?
Cocktail the movie.
Frozen daiquiri or frozen margarita?
Daiquiri.
Frozen daiquiri, not daiquiri. Oh, I'm talking frozen daiquiri.
I got that one wrong.
You can't have the...
Frozen margarita.
Okay, all right.
I'll take it.
Dive bar or speakeasy?
Dive bar.
Okay. That's what we all say. Bacon, egg, and cheese sandwich or chilaquiles?
Bacon, egg, and cheese. I could go for one of those right now.
And then the last one, which we ask every guest, is butter or olive oil?
Butter.
Butter makes it better. Thanks, Brad.
Thanks, Andrew.
This podcast has been brought to you by Carrie Polis, Emma Wertzman, and Lily Sherman, with editing by Mitra Kaboli. Our theme music is by Valerie and the Gradys. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to tell us about this or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Plus, we're also offering a deal with our podcast listeners. Go to bonappetit.com/gift to see what we have. Thanks for listening.